This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. You've probably heard about President George Herbert Walker Bush's comments about his son's Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. He called them both hard asses, charging that Cheney had created his own empire within the administration and that Rumsfeld was arrogant and lacked humility. Bush didn't let his son off the hook, saying the buck stopped with him. This is what our guest John Meacham writes about in his new book about George Herbert Walker Bush called Destiny and Power. He spent a lot of time interviewing Bush, who gave him access to his diaries, as did Barbara Bush. The book begins with the Bush dynasty and how the president's privileged childhood influenced his life, as well as key moments in his long career in government, including high points and low points. John Meacham is a Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian. He's a contributing editor at Time, executive vice president, and executive editor at Random House, and joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So why did George Herbert Walker Bush want to work with you on this biography?
I'm going to use a technical term. I don't want to overwhelm you, but I groveled.
Did you?
I wanted to do it. I had first met him 17 years ago in 1998. Michael Beschloss, my friend, the historian, and I had gone to Walker's Point in Maine, and I immediately understood in a way I had never before when I met him how he had become president of the United States. He possessed a quiet, persistent charisma and embodied very clearly a fading order of public service. He had more in common, has more in common, I think, with Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt and even the founding fathers than he does with his successors. And when the opportunity arose and he said that he had these White House diaries, that I just jumped out of my chair as fast as I could, because what he did a couple of times a week for 4 years is he would dictate into an audio recorder. So in many ways, and the book draws heavily, the presidential part of the book draws heavily on those diaries, it's as close as most of us are going to get to being president. He's a one-term president, but he had enough action in 4 years that most people get in eight. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the first Gulf War, the budget deal that set up the prosperity of the 90s, the terrible 1992 campaign, the end of the Soviet Union. Tumultuous time, quiet but deeply ambitious and competitive president at the heart of it.
Did you identify with him as a fellow WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant? Did you recognize something of yourself in this man?
Well, Freud said all biography is actually autobiography.
Yeah, exactly.
but Freud's discredited, I think, largely now.
Sure.
Unquestionably. I sort of understood the zip code in which I was operating. But what's so remarkable about George H.W. Bush, I think, is how what was his characteristics, which were seen as vices in real time, have come to be seen as virtues the farther away we get. The reticence, the dignity, the I don't feel, you know, the refusal to participate in what I call confessional politics. You know, this was not the kind of politician who could go on Arsenio Hall. He would never have said, "I feel your pain," even though he deeply felt pain. The biggest surprise to me as I got to know him in person and through these diaries and then the vast archives at, down in College Station, Texas, is just how emotional a man he really is. He cries, you know, as Christopher Buckley once said, more than a Sicilian grandmother.
Which doesn't seem like the President Bush that we would remember, or even looking at his childhood, his upbringing. I mean, it seemed like a very stiff upper lip. It had a kind of British feel to it.
Externally, yeah. And that's one of the fascinating things is, yes, you're right. If you were looking at this boy growing up, born in Milton, Massachusetts, grew up in Greenwich, spent the summers in Maine.
Boarding school.
Andover, boarding school, Yale, the war. You would think of him as kind of having just stepped out of a John Cheever story or the Brooks Brothers catalog. But he is more complicated than that. He's more interesting than that. He would not have become president of the United States if he had only been that. If he hadn't moved to Texas in 1948 after the war, wouldn't have been president. The Democrats wanted him to switch parties in the early 1960s, back when there was one-party government down there. He refused. He barely got on the ticket with Ronald Reagan in 1980. Neither Bush would have been president had Reagan actually cut that deal with Gerald Ford. So his life is full of these near misses, and great biography, I think, is always the story of tension. And the tension in George H.W. Bush's head and heart was the mission to serve, taught him by his family, to whom much is given, much is expected, but the drive to succeed and to serve in the way he wanted to serve. Someone had to win, someone had to lose. And so you have this wonderfully complex interplay of ambition and service and duty all rolled up in this lanky guy from Greenwich.
And a mix of modesty and confidence. That's another thing that struck me as well.
That's a very good way to put it. There is modesty. You know, his mother always said, "I don't want to hear about the great I am. Don't be a braggadocio, George." He'd come in and say, "I hit a double." She'd say, "How did the team do?" Now, strange then to make a career choice where the first person pronoun is pretty important. You know, Peggy Noonan talks about how when she was writing speeches for him, she just did away with the first person pronoun. You know,
he wouldn't have it.
It would just, she'd say, moved to Texas, started a business, ran for Congress. So one of the reasons he was often inarticulate, I think, is he was hearing his mother's voice in his head saying, "You're talking about yourself too much, George."
You write, and I scribbled this down because I thought it was so interesting, that he's a flirt.
Oh, my God.
With men and women.
Men and women, like. but women in particular. He is one of the great flirts. I've watched it over the years. And he was in the early 1960s. It's funny when you go back, and one of the joys of doing what I do is you get to go read old newspapers. And one of the joys of the old Texas newspapers is he is persistently described as Kennedy-esque, handsome, country club matron swooning over him in those early 1960s races. He's a really handsome, good-looking guy, and was particularly so in his early years. There's a wonderful line from the diary that Warren Beatty in 1988 told one of Bush's Hollywood friends. He said, "You know, you have a Gary Cooper there. They can't beat him." And that's not a bad way of thinking about it. He is kind of a Jimmy Stewart, Gary Cooper presence.
Did he think a lot about his appearance? It's hard to imagine.
Oh, my God.
That upbringing.
He is the single worst dresser of anyone I know. You know,
mismatch.
I have a 13-year-old son who wears those neon clothes, you know, that they all wear now. He looks like a can of Sprite most of the time. He dresses a bit like George Orwell.
Really?
No. When his daughter Dora was being married at Camp David, he'd forgotten to pack a suit. So he ends up wearing, you know, a bolo tie he picked up somewhere and some pinstripe pants. They looked like the Yankees. And, you know, he's always had the sock thing that's been going on recently. Colin Powell remember being in a conference about the Panama action, and Bush had one sock on that said Mary and one that said Christmas. So, you know, there are these touches. And he loved the White House. He loved it, and the puppies and the dogs, and loved the mansion and the way that T.R. loved it. So it's a big personality, and that didn't always come across. I mean, a lot of us thought of him, I think, as sort of the Dana Carvey type, the guy who didn't know a supermarket scanner worked. You know, he came from a privileged background, but we weren't really hiring him for that. 1989 to 1993 was a time of immense change in the world. And if I had told you, if you and I had been sitting here in 1980, we would have said, all right, in 12 years' time, in a decade's time, the Soviet Union is going to cease to exist without a shot being fired. We both would have thought we were just whistling Dixie. And yet, because of both Ronald Reagan and George Bush, American leadership played a critical role. You know, they didn't end the Cold War. You know, the peoples of Eastern Europe, the peoples of the republics of the Soviet Union, the countless acts of courage, you know, it was their desire for freedom and independence that drove it. But Reagan helped and Bush managed it. I think they needed each other historically.
Those two, and Bush.
I do. I think Reagan did things that Bush could not do in articulating a case for the West. And I don't think President Reagan could have handled the management details of the 4 years where George H.W. Bush – and, you know, go ask Mikhail Gorbachev.
In fact, you have an interesting several scenes where Bush sort of holds his tongue in a way to give – I'm not sure it was exactly saving face, but it seemed like Gorbachev really appreciated his diplomacy.
Here's a connection between childhood and the presidency. In childhood, he was George Bush was known as half-half because whenever he had a treat, he would cut it in half and give the other kid half the dessert, half the candy bar. Cut to 1990, 1991, 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. He's able, half-half Bush is able to put himself in the shoes both of Gorbachev and of those to Gorbachev's right in the Soviet Union. He's able to imaginatively see how he would feel if his system was falling apart. And he knew that the possibility of a violent reaction from Soviet hardliners was a real possibility. And one factor, and we all forget this, one of the reasons he thought that in November of 1989 is why? What had happened in June of 1989? Tiananmen Square.
Of course.
So he had seen a repressive regime take military action against protesters. The wall comes down. He plays it very cool. The Democrats and the press think he doesn't understand what's going on.
Because he's not celebrating,
Because
right?
he's not celebrating. What he's doing is he's trying to prevent another Tiananmen. And he doesn't get credit for it until now. But it was a brilliant diplomatic move, and it was based on his character.
Well, we're almost having a break here, and it's hard not to think about those particular skills at that time and whether they would work today at all, you know, dealing with all the dictators and ISIS in the world, you know, whether those kinds of skills are translatable.
I'd love to have the chance to find out, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a man who is the un-Trump. I mean, someone who spent his life training to be president. Someone who, ambassador to the UN, envoy to China, chairman of the Republican National Committee, director of the CIA, vice president for 8 years.
Those would be disqualifiers today for a number of people.
You couldn't be nominated. I mean, imagine that paper trail. Just for any one of those jobs in particular, the UN votes, having run the RNC during Watergate, even though he called on Nixon to resign, he did it late. Director of the CIA, who China, 4 years in Congress. George H.W. Bush is a figure out of a world that has vanished politically, and that, you know, centrism is not always the right answer. The middle way is not always the right way. But sometimes it is. And sometimes you need someone whose ambient reality is actually doing the business of governing. And that's what Bush did.
And that's John Meacham, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about his new book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, John Meacham is our guest. We're talking about his new book about President George Herbert Walker Bush. It's titled Destiny and Power, and it begins with his privileged childhood, his naval service, his years as U.S. ambassador, head of the CIA, vice president, and president. And again, if you want to join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. There's just one part of his early life as a father. His daughter, Robin, died. She's about 3 years old. She died of leukemia. And her parents, George Bush and Barbara Bush, they didn't know about that. I guess a child could so young could die of leukemia.
They'd never heard the word when they received the diagnosis. It was the first time they'd heard the word leukemia in the Midland doctor's office in 1953.
They tear up. He in particular tears up as he remembers her. And you do include in here, I guess it's a, is it a, something he wrote about Robin. And I just have to say, I could not get through it without just being moved to tears.
Robin died over the course of 8 months or so in 1953. She was the second child after George W. Was born in 46. She was born in 49. The letter you're alluding to is a remarkable piece that he wrote his mother several years after Robin had died. She'd been buried in Greenwich, though her remains have now been taken to College Station, where she'll be buried, where she has been buried on the same plot where her parents will be buried eventually. And it's just it's an amazing letter.
Well, I couldn't get through it without crying, but
give me a second and I'll give it. So this is George Herbert Walker Bush writing to his mother a few years after the loss of his and Barbara's daughter. There is about our house a need, the running, pulsating restlessness of the four boys as they struggle to learn and grow. The world embraces them. But all this wonder needs a counterpart. We need some starched, crisp frocks to go with all our torn blue jeans and helmets. We need some soft blonde hair to offset those crew cuts. We need a dollhouse to stand firm against our forts and rackets and baseball cards. We need someone who, while the boys are outside scrambling to catch the elusive ball aimed ever roofward, but usually thudding against the screens. We need a legitimate Christmas angel, one who doesn't have cuffs beneath the dress. We need someone who's afraid of frogs. We need someone to cry when I get mad, not argue. We need a little one who can kiss without leaving egg or jam or gum. We need a girl. We had one once. She'd fight and cry and play and make her way just like the rest. But there was about her a certain softness. She was patient. Her hugs were just a little less wiggly. Like them, she'd climb in to sleep with me, but somehow she'd fit. Her peace made me feel strong and so very important. My daddy had a caress, a certain ownership, which touched a slightly different spot than the "hi, Dad" I love so much. But she is still with us. We need her, and yet we have her. We can't touch her, and yet we can feel her. We hope she'll stay in our house for a long, long time. I asked President Bush to read that in his retirement office, and he was sobbing so hard that his chief of staff came in, who had been in the next office, and sort of said, "What's going on?" And I said, "I'd ask the president to read that letter out loud." And she said, "Well, why did you ask him to do that?" Right. And I said, "Well, if you want to know someone's heart," and before I could finish the sentence, the president said, "You have to know what breaks it." And that's what broke George Bush's heart.
To this day.
Unto this hour. And I think there are two things. I think the loss of Robin and his wartime experience, which were both early exposures to the fragility of life. He lost two crewmen in combat over Chichijima in the Bonin Islands in 1944. And he always wondered, why was I spared? Why was I the one?
Could I have done more?
The answer was no, he couldn't have done more. But he had to spend the rest of his life answering the question, why was I spared? And I think when I asked him what he learned from the loss of Robin, he said that life was unpredictable and fragile and precious. And I think that those two experiences were a key foundation for his code of always looking ahead, always moving, always believing that he had to somehow prove that he was commensurate with survival. That he had survived, they had not, his little girl had not survived. And I'm convinced that at some level and to some degree, his drive to achieve was fueled by a sense that he had to make himself worthy of having been spared.
Does he feel that way? I mean, you feel that way about him. But I've
made that case to him, and he's looked at me.
What does that mean?
It means yes. But that's my biographical interpretation. I made that point to him as recently as Monday. And I think he believes in letting the historian sort these things out. But I'd bet the farm that's true.
He has been described as someone, you know, not known for introspection. But I have to say, reading your book, I would disagree with that.
he doesn't like talking about himself out loud, but sure, he can be self-involved. The diary itself, I think, gives a slightly skewed view of this, and here's why. It was the only place where he could be self-involved. He told me once that no one wants to hear a president say, "Oh, woe is me." You know, you're just damn
I have the hardest job in the world, you know, right?
Hated. Never would have said that. Totally against the code. He was, you know, as you put it, just damned lucky to be there. So the diary, the audio diary he kept on which I drew, was really therapeutic. It was the one place where even to Mrs. Bush he wouldn't complain. So it's the one place where he could unload. And classic George Bush, he would unload but then talk himself back up into the game. You know, like, oh, here comes Gingrich again. You know, guy, oh, damn it. Blah, 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 blah. But I'm president. He's not. I've just got to work hard, work the problem, keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Always forward. Always forward. That's George Bush.
Well, some of his comments about Dick Cheney when he was vice president in his son's administration. Also, Donald Rumsfeld when he was secretary of defense in his son's administration has gotten a fair amount of attention, calling them both hard asses or iron asses.
Iron asses,
I should say. And about Cheney, he said he seemed knuckling under to the real hard-charging guys who wanted to fight about everything, use force to get our way in the Middle East. He criticized Cheney for sort of creating his own department within, I guess, the Department of State. Rumsfeld, and I have a feeling that there's some rivalry that goes back between George Herbert Walker Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, but he doesn't seem to like Rumsfeld very much, calling him arrogant.
Which is probably the worst thing that George Bush could call you.
To call you arrogant?
Arrogant. I think that's true. But President Bush, 41, offered these criticisms to me in interviews from October of 2008 through about 2012. I confirmed all the quotations with him again last year before publication. He believed that his son's administration had an overly hawkish tone. He worried that Cheney, as you quoted, was too eager to project force around the globe. He thought that Rumsfeld had failed to revisit decisions once made about the conduct of war, of the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. To my knowledge, it's the first time he's ever been this direct, this honest on these three questions. He said that he did not believe his son should have used the term axis of evil, that hot rhetoric was good at getting headlines but might not be diplomatically useful. And I think the reason he's told me these things, I think, is he believes in the historical record. Mm-hmm. A man who keeps a diary for all those years wants the record to be to reflect reality accurately, and I think these were his issues with what happened. I don't think he thinks that Dick Cheney was really the president. I don't think he believes that, as he put it, you know, George W. was not some dolt, some dummy going in there. He did, that conventional wisdom is not right, and I don't think he disagreed with him radically on the actual decision to go into Iraq.
Different times, but different response to Saddam Hussein.
Different wars, different reasons. They both told me, and strategic environment was different. But more than that, 41 wrote a letter to his son saying, you know, ratifying his course. Mm-hmm. You know, and in his own war in 1990-91, he was willing to risk impeachment if Congress had not given him the authority to go in, and he used the language of good versus evil. So, to some extent, was he criticizing in his son something that he was uncomfortable about himself? Mm-hmm. He wouldn't be the first human being to do that.
He called Lynn Cheney iron ass as well and seemed to think that Lynn Cheney and their daughter had undue influence on Dick Cheney himself.
Yeah, he was trying to figure out why the Cheney he had known as Secretary of Defense seemed so much more conservative. Cheney was always conservative. But he did bring Lynn and Liz into it, and Dick, Vice President Cheney, whom
he
I
didn't like that.
Well, he wore the iron ass label with a certain amount of witty pride. He did say that he did not agree with President Bush's putting it off on Liz and Lynn. They're two formidable women in their own rights. But it's interesting that that's what 41 was sitting around thinking about.
Yeah. What does he mean by iron ass?
Iron ass means inflexible. Data resistant. Stubborn to a fault. It's funny, I spent a long time on this book, and it may be remembered for the phrase iron ass.
Here we are talking about it on the radio.
Where's Bill Sapphire when we need it? The etymology of iron ass.
That's John Meacham, our guest in this hour of Radio Time.
That's my contribution to historical literature. Take that, McCullough.
There you go. Destiny and Power is the title of his new book. It's called, and it's subtitled, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush, 41, as he is known, or I guess Poppy, as he is known as well. And our guest spent many years talking with George Bush and also listening to his diary and the diary of Barbara Bush as well. And to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me ask you about Iran-Contra, because I have to say that even as you write about it, and clearly this is a man you respect and have a lot of admiration for,
sure,
that this was a really dark time for him and perhaps a time when he really went against whatever his values were. And is lie too strong a word?
No, I don't think so. He initially denied that there had been arms sales to Iran. George Shultz goes to him and says, you were there. You got to knock this off. The argument, as people may remember, was George Shultz, the Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberg, the Secretary of Defense, were arguing against the Arms for Hostages Initiative. The National Security Advisor, Oliver North, who was working for the NSC, President Reagan, and President Bush, Vice President Bush, rather, were more or less for it. It was a misguided policy, backfired in many ways. And it made Bush feel. It made Bush appear to be someone who was not being fully candid by saying he was not in the loop. He knew plenty, and in fact, leaked to the newspapers what he knew. I think it's an unusual.
Why did he do that, though? Why do you think he
get
did
it out
that?
Early? Get it out early before the 88 campaign. He didn't like the idea that we were working through a third nation. It was going through Israel. So I think it's an uncharacteristic moment, but it was a Machiavellian one where he was having to balance staying close to Reagan, who remained popular with the Republican base, and keep himself out of trouble. That's one of the things about Bush that I think is important, and a lot of Democrats I've talked to who about this have said that, this is the last Republican president they can really sort of get behind at all. And Iran-Contra is an exception to that. But this is a man who was never really deeply ideologically wedded to either side, left or right. So he was not driven by a fervor in the way Oliver North was. So much so that he was such ultimately a pragmatic figure as opposed to a movement conservative, that when he was president, he passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. He transformed almost every building in America for the disabled. He violated his own no new taxes pledge to put the country on a stronger fiscal footing. He signed the Clean Air Act, which is essentially still our environmental policy. He had a much bigger domestic record than people have appreciated. And I think the reason people don't appreciate it is it was too liberal for Republicans to embrace, and Democrats didn't want to give a Republican president too much credit. That's why history in this case matters. This book is my attempt to look at him whole and biographically. It's not a book about it's not a political biography. This is his whole life. And when he fell short, as he fell short on Iran-Contra, as he fell short on failing to explain why he broke Read My Lips, he fell short because he was human and frail and given to given to sin and shortcoming like the rest of us.
Do you think he was also ruthless? I'm thinking about the campaign about against Dukakis, the Willie Horton ads. I mean, the way that – and there were some others as well.
Yeah. I think that he was willing to say and do what he needed to do to win. What ultimately redeems him, in my view, is that whatever he did on the way to amassing power, once he had that power, he was able to put the country ahead of his own political interest. My favorite example is in 1964, when he was running for the Senate in Texas, he opposed the Civil Rights Act, now a piece of American scripture. But what does he do in 1968 when he's actually elected to Congress? He votes for open housing, lifting racial discrimination from the real estate market. So he opposes the act on the campaign trail, the big Civil Rights Act. But when he has a chance to vote for a civil rights measure, he votes against his constituents' wishes. He goes down to Houston, gets screamed at for going out and selling out to the left. He is one of the last figures of the American center.
And not a flip-flopper?
I don't think it's flip-flopping to call him like you see him. I really don't.
Even if you say one thing to get elected and do another thing when you're in office?
Well, you know, there's some founding fathers who did a lot of work in this city who did the same thing. Thomas Jefferson wouldn't have bought Louisiana if he had stuck by his rhetoric. So, you know, politics is the art of the possible. Politics is messy. And if you want consistency, then you should join the Academy.
John Meacham, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. A fair amount of Bush news these days. Jeb Bush, of course, running to be president of the United States, and a new book out about his father, written by our guest John Meacham, and it's called Destiny and Power. And again, to join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Some have wondered about the timing of this book, with Jeb Bush struggling to make it to the top of the Republican Party to be the candidate for president, wondering whether the timing of this book hurts him, helps him. What do you think?
I don't think it has much effect either way. The publication schedule was totally separate from the political calendar. This was set before we knew he was going to run for president. And he's got a problem with someone named Donald, but it's Trump, not Rumsfeld. Insofar, perhaps, as readers are reminded of the public service of his father, perhaps that helps a bit, I guess, maybe. Mm. But I think it's a little bit of a confection to try to see this as affecting that campaign. I think that I like to think there's a lot here that tells us about politics today, because we are talking about 25 years ago.
Yes, we are.
But it's funny, 25 years used to mean something. this is like reading a book about John F. Kennedy in 1988. Think about that for a second.
I'm thinking about that.
It's kind of, I don't know about you, but the distance between 1988 and 1963 seems a lot bigger than 1993 to 2016, but that's where we are.
You mentioned Trump. There was a time when Trump actually thought of hitching his wagon to George Herbert Walker Bush.
One of the great – I fell out of my chair when I was reading this in the diary. In the 88, Trump and Lee Atwater apparently were talking about whether Trump might make a good running mate and Bush for Bush. And Bush wrote –
I
in
cannot
his
imagine that pairing.
Bush, neither could Bush. He wrote in his diary, strange, unbelievable. But the Donald was there. He's everywhere.
Well, as you said, and it's absolutely true, he was a one-term president. Yeah. You describe, and it has to be true, especially when you look at his bio, the fact that he lost to Bill Clinton, who he thought of as a draft dodger, how difficult it was for him to recover from that loss. Not that he hadn't had other elections that he had lost, but this was,
it was
after 4 years in office.
It was all. I mean, he says, God, it was ghastly. I don't think he got over it really until 94 when the son started running for governor. The emotional life, one of the things in the book that I find historically fascinating was how fundamentally and emotionally despondent he was after the end of the Gulf War. He never celebrated it. He would like Saddam to have been deposed. There was a lot of intelligence wrong that suggested that some general was probably going to take care of it for him, some Iraqi general. He had a thyroid condition that exacerbated his acuity and energy levels.
Made him cranky.
Graves'
right?
disease, yeah. It's very hard to treat thyroids. Even now, he's being treated for it. So it was kind of a perfect storm, 1992. I think there are three things that happened that sort of also shape our politics now. One is the rise of freelance partisanship. You know, the idea of Newt Gingrich opposing a president of his own party over the budget deal in 1990 really created the right-wing-leaning Republican Party that we see today. There's a direct line between Gingrich's rebellion against George Bush and the Tea Party and the world we see now. In fact, there's a great anecdote. Vin Weber, a congressman from Minnesota, who ran Gingrich's campaign to become the House whip, they go to the White House to have a beer with Bush. It's Gingrich and this other congressman. And they can tell that Bush wants to say something, but he can't quite bring himself to do it. So Weber finally says, "Mr. President, would you tell us what worries you most about us?" And Bush looks relieved because he has an opening. And he says, "I worry that sometimes your idealism might get in the way of what I think of as responsible governance." Hmm. And Weber said he always appreciated that Bush used the word idealism, not ideology, not nuttiness, not purity, although he could have used any of those. And then when he decided to read my lips, Weber and Gingrich say that's what he meant. You know, George Bush was fundamentally, you know, a good government, sensible Republican in a party that was moving ever rightward against him. That's one thing that was changing. The other, the 24-hour news cycle was starting. Cable news was gearing up. Everybody had an opinion and would express it. And the third is the rise of confessional politics, of which Clinton was such a master. And what strikes me again and again in the diaries and in talking to him was how deeply emotional this man was and how determined he was to appear unemotional. There's a scene in Krakow when he's vice president, and he's shown into a children's leukemia ward in what must be one of the world's worst pieces of White House advance in history. And the cameras are behind him, but he won't turn around because he's crying. And if he turns around and he's crying, the story becomes about him, not about the kids. And so he's talking to himself in his diary with an interior monologue, and he says over this little boy who has leukemia, he says, "I'm sure he's wondering why this old man is crying, but I hope he knows that I love him." That's a George Bush we don't know, and that's the George Bush you meet here.
How much do you think literally that second that he took to look at his watch with the debate with Ross Perot and Bill Clinton, how much do you think that ended his presidency? We'll get to our callers.
It was ending anyway, but it put a big exclamation mark on it. It was a disastrous debate. George Bush in a town hall debate, looking at his watch, not understanding the question about the national debt. It was just a harrowing moment where all these forces came together. If you watch the YouTube, if you're really bored today, if you go watch a little bit of the video of that, Clinton has this wolfish look on his face because his era is beginning and George H.W. Bush's era is ending in that moment. It's almost as though Bush is checking his watch, and there went 20th century politics. And 21st century politics was beginning.
Just one little quick thing, because it's so interesting that George Bush brings these two men together, Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush, together to deal with some of the crises around the world. And I think they're flying to Asia somewhere.
The tsunami.
The tsunami. And George Herbert Walker Bush's comments about Bill Clinton is that he just won't stop talking.
This is the way Bush said it to me. He said, he talks all the time. And he also said, who knows if he's right? You know, Clinton will say, there are 132 windmills in Nigeria, George. We need to do something about that. And Bush is saying, how does he know there are 132 windmills in Nigeria? And what am I supposed to do about it? It's an odd couple.
I think it's a father-son couple in a way?
Well, in two cases. It's funny that two of the three presidents, all three presidents who have succeeded George Herbert Walker Bush had father issues with him. Barack Obama reveres him. Obama did not know his father. Clinton reveres him, did not know his father. And, of course, the man's actual son.
I was going to say, who had father issues,
well,
I guess.
Well, certainly was a son.
Let me get Brian from Horsham, from Horsham to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Mr. Meech and Marty. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted a quick example or two of George Bush's handling of the Soviet Union collapse. It always seemed to me like perhaps he just stood back and he had less of a friendly relationship with Gorbachev, at least when he first took office. So to me, it always seemed like he just sort of let things happen. And then, of course, we have the Russia we have today. So I wanted to get Mr. Meechan's comment on that, exactly like how did he behave in a skillful way?
Now, Brian, thanks for the call. Go ahead, John.
Sure, absolutely. He did buy Gorbachev some time. He bought, by not responding to the fall of the wall in a triumphalist way, he helped prop up Gorbachev. He cut a couple of deals with him on trade in exchange for better Soviet behavior in Lithuania, for instance. He was trying to balance with judicious support for Gorbachev, but also keeping an open channel to Yeltsin and some of the other emerging leaders of the republics in order to be ready, in order to bring stability to an inherently unstable situation. His handling of the coup in August of 1991, you could say, was a case of his sitting back. What his diary shows, what his phone records show, is that he was working the phones constantly, sending signals, trying to keep stability and order. You know, foreign policy is often unglamorous, and there's a little more unglamorous, if you will, than the management of some of these issues. But he thought that Gorbachev was the best bet for stability. Bush wanted stability, and the fact that we have the Russia we have today is a product of Americans who believe that in self-determination. So
he got elected, right?
Yeah.
We have a caller who has wanted to know how much advice Senior gave Junior, his son, during W's administration, and if he ever took his advice since he is critical of Cheney and Rumsfeld.
If you read Decision Points, President Bush 43's biography, you find a number of occasions where he asked for counsel, usually on personnel matters. They did talk about Iraq in 2002, 2003. President Bush Sr. had private anxieties about it, but he put those aside. He put his faith in his son and supported him. My sense is that there was not a huge amount of advice giving or advice taking. Part of that is because President Bush 41 was always deferential to whomever the president was, and part of it was 43 believed that he'd been elected president and he knew what to do, and he had his own team, his own advisors. We can spend the rest of our lives arguing about that, and a lot of people will, that he should have done more with his father. But the character of the two men, the nature of the relationship was such that there was not an enormous amount of advice given. There was a lot of love expressed and a lot of contact. But George H.W. Bush was not saying, you got to move House Resolution 380 out of subcommittee.
Not that kind of a relationship. Let me get Ahmed from Wilmington to join us on Radio Times. Ahmed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great discussion as always.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to make a quick point that, When I was a senior in college, former President Bush came to my college and gave at Washington College in Maryland and gave an address for the winter convocation. And I found myself really listening intently and agreeing with this very, very intelligent man who showed great intelligence, sensitivity, and nuance. And I just found myself thinking, I wish I would have been able to see this when he was president, and perhaps I would have agreed with him more. But I wonder if he wasn't able to show, as your guest said earlier regarding the leukemia incident in Poland, that I wonder if President Bush wasn't able to show that side of himself, either because of advisors or because of politics. But when I heard him speak at my college when he was not president anymore, I just remember thinking, this is such an intelligent man who's explained things so well, shown sensitivity and nuance, and I wish we could have seen that when he was the president.
Oh, man, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. John Meacham, go ahead.
It's a fascinating observation. I think you're right. Now, former presidents do tend to always look a little better because they're out of the crucible. But he was not the most articulate of presidents. I think part of it was because his mind moved faster than his mouth. He didn't give himself over to black and white issues. He saw nuance, and so he would start to make a statement and then qualify it. And by the time it got out, it would be totally mangled in many ways. But it wasn't his advisors. He did believe, Dan Quayle told me this, it was a very shrewd observation, that George Bush was results-oriented. He really believed that if he got to the right result in terms of governance, that the country would understand that and give him credit for it. And so he didn't believe in going out and doing the explaining. And that's one of his failures. I'm very tough on him for this. One of his failures as president was that he did not understand the bully pulpit and should have done more with that.
He told you, and I'm looking at a quote, he said, I feel like an asterisk. I'm lost between the glory of Reagan, monuments everywhere, trumpets, the great hero, and the trials and tribulations of my sons. And I'm quoting here from, I think it's the New York Times, and what if they find an empty deck of cards looking at the judgment of historians?
Right, right. Now, he told me that in 2006. He felt forgotten and overlooked, as he said. I mean, he laid out the case. It's almost impossible to imagine another president saying that, certainly in our contemporary times. He was honest with me. He was candid about it. And there's not an empty deck of cards there. This is a man of substance. He wasn't perfect.
Was he a great president?
He was an accomplished president and a considerable one. Great, near great, I've never bought into those categories. But he was a consequential president. The world was better off after he left office than it would have been otherwise. And that's the test of a great presidency, is the test of a great life.
On that note, John Meacham, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, listen to us on satellite radio, and you can sign up for our newsletter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.